Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And our listeners like products. And so we bring you interesting and unusual products.
And we got some unusual ones for you today.
Yeah, well, we do. And
we're not going to warn you in advance.
No.
You'll have to hang in there to the end. And the end, I can assure you, the end will be a surprise.
Yes. We are curious. Let's say we're just curious. We follow our line of interest and sometimes in odd directions. But it's also this time of year, and we like to present products because it coincides with the greatest food show on earth, which is the Specialty Food Association's Summer Fancy Food Show in New York City, which is 3 days of unbridled sampling.
Exactly, and we sure have been sampling. And how many of you can put a name to this slogan? It takes a tough guy to make a tender chicken. and the answer in this case is not Frank Perdue. The answer in the case of today's program is Jesse Emmer.
Jesse Solomon.
Jesse Solomon.
Emmer and Company. It's not a company. It's Emmer and Co. And Jesse's going to explain to us what that means when we interview them.
And we're going to talk about what it takes to make a really tender chicken and what it was like when Peter cooked it and served it for Miss Anne. Yeah. So there. And you'll wish you could get one too.
Listeners, Emmer and Co., which does not stand for company, by the way, is a revelation in heritage chicken. And we're talking to Jesse Solomon, and I'm trying to find out exactly how he got in this place in time raising chickens. Jesse, you're going to have to help me out here because yours is a complicated story.
Well, thanks for having me on the air, Ann and Peter. Yeah, so, you know, the journey to chickens actually started quite a while back in 2008 when I was in Ethiopia working for an investment company, and I became obsessed with large-scale agriculture projects where you could really build an entire production system from the ground up without inheriting any of the broken models that existed today. So it was my first experience with looking at that, just that general concept of, like, we could feed a lot of people and build a system from the ground up and do it the right way, scale up a system with organic practices, with better farmer relationships, with regenerative practices that improve the environment.
Yeah, do you know Dan Barber?
Yeah, so Dan, I'm a huge Dan Barber fan.
Yeah, me too. And you read Third Plate.
Yeah. And, you know, we're good friends with the farm managers at Stone Barns.
Uh-huh.
And we share a lot, all of the similar, you know, perspectives on, you know, how to create better holistic.
We should add here, because we found this out just a few minutes ago, that when Jesse was doing this, he was a banker. Doesn't sound like those two things necessarily go together all that well, but obviously in some fashion they did. But you had another life experience that got you closer to food, closer to the food you were eating, and by definition then closer to the food that you're selling to other people.
That's right, yeah. So fast forward past Ethiopia, I was living in New York, and I read a book called Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. And it was just a really great dive into the fish industry, the beef industry, and the chicken
industry.
He's
wonderful, too.
He is, fantastic writer. And after I read that book, I decided that I was a vegetarian. I just couldn't eat meat anymore if I didn't know with 100% certainty where it came from and that if I didn't have that relationship with my food. So I started to hunt, actually, and to this day, I still only eat meat that I hunt myself or my own chickens. Or if you're a farmer and you raise something and, you know, I can go to your farm, I will eat that. But through hunting, it was really my way of connecting with my food on a really intimate and personal level and knowing that it was the purest form of food I could eat. And when I would share those meals with family and friends and be able to connect them with their food on that level. That was really the genesis of Emmer & Co. It was about replicating that as close to wild experience for as many people as possible, where we could cut through label confusions and really rebuild a system from the ground up around a brand that people could trust.
Now, it's interesting because the model for producing vast quantities of inexpensive chicken in the United States developed over the years by people like Tyson and
Frank Perdue.
Where,
he looks like a chicken, by the way, when he was alive.
Where they don't actually grow the chickens, they have a network of farmers who grow the chickens. Now, your model, if I understand it correctly, your model of producing chickens is very similar to that. You have a group of farmers who are your farmers, but you're not building the chickens yourself.
So actually, as we grow, because of our holistic management, where we grow our chickens with other species of animals like cattle so that we never over impact any one part of the environment. And we're always focused on regenerating soil health, growing deeper root systems, growing taller grasses. We're actually going to be partnering with other cattle ranches where we can grow our chickens in rotation with their cattle to achieve the same effect.
Oh, how interesting.
And now that's
the Michael Pollan model, right?
Similar, yeah, and you know this is actually how animals would exist in nature without us anyway. It's how nature stays in balance. And with this kind of model, what we're actually going to be doing is hiring our workers and employing them, providing them with benefits, and really creating a different kind of model where we can create training programs and upward mobility and away from that disintermediation of the farm workers and the food.
But you got to be careful because who was it? The meat people, the pork guy that we interviewed. Remember?
No.
He started this company and it got out of control with the size. Remember? We've run into him.
Oh, you mean the guy who had the weekend place, and his wife gave him two pigs for his birthday. That's the one you're talking about?
No.
You lost.
Well, you know the old saying is rabbits don't breed like rabbits, pigs breed like rabbits.
I
didn't know that saying, but I'll tell you they did. No, that was somebody in England.
Yeah, I was thinking of that experience. I can't figure out what it is that Anne's talking about with pigs.
No, it was a pork raising guy and that ranch, Nyman Ranch, the whole company structure.
Oh, right.
And he was farmer, whatever
Paul
his name was.
Paul Willis.
Yeah.
You probably know him at least by name, huh?
I know of him. Yeah.
And he said he ran his business from his kitchen table in Western Iowa, someplace.
That's right. Yeah.
And but he had the same. He had a network of farmers.
Yeah, and he lost control of this humane approach that he was using because of the size.
Yeah, so by, you know, managing the production ourselves, that's one way to control for that.
Yeah. Where are you, by the way?
He's in California.
So, yeah, all of our farming is in Northern California. So the primary ranch that we're starting on is in Red Bluff. It's between Redding and Chico.
Okay.
Okay, so it's up the valley.
Yeah, and so our vision for what this company is going to become is a national brand, and we want to have production hubs all across the country. We're starting on the West Coast, where we can really scale up this model for how to raise slow growth chickens on pasture with these holistic management principles, mm-hmm. and so that's kind of our focus for the, you know, short term, and then once that system scales up the right way, then we can replicate that in other parts of the country.
Now let's go back over the word you just snuck in there, because I think it's important that people realize you talk about slow growth chicken, exactly the opposite of what chicken head Frank Perdue would like to have happen.
There was a recent New York Times article talking about a slow-growing chicken that tastes better.
Yes.
And I can send that to you guys. And it profiled Purdue specifically, and out of any of the companies, they're actually the most forward-thinking.
Oh, okay. Oh, good, good, good.
Well, yeah, he's gone. His son's running it now, right?
Jim Purdue. Yeah. And they now own Nyman Ranch. They
Is that what they bought? Nyman Ranch. Okay.
Yeah, and so they're actually, again, very forward-thinking in terms of higher welfare, changing their supply chain, focusing on really, just kind of what comes next. And so, this is finding chickens that grow the way they're supposed to, so they don't have any health problems. They can run around, they can be happy, and that actually also develops better flavor. You know, when chickens move around, their muscles get oxygenated, and that oxygenation creates darker meat. Darker meat tends to have more flavor than white meat. And so a slower-growing bird that is more active will actually just generally taste better.
Well, we went to a tasting for heritage turkeys one year. And, I was really excited because there were some legs left over, and they were trying to get people to take the leftovers. And so I trophied one.
She trophied a wild turkey thigh and wing. And we got it home, and we were going to have it for lunch the next day. I got the sharpest knife, the biggest and sharpest knife in our collection. I couldn't even make a dent. It was the most incredibly difficult, and because it turned out that the chef who cooked the turkeys, who was a good chef, actually had never come across a wild turkey before. So he had no idea that the only way you can cope with that and get it all tender at the same time is to cut off the breasts and not start cooking those until 2 hours after you've done the thighs.
That's right.
In which case it will work out properly. And
that's right.
I want to let you know what we did with the chicken sample that you sent us, because I had long arguments with Anne about this, because
you
sent us this beautiful recipe using salt and baking soda and that would guarantee crisp skin and all that stuff. Well, I am one of the relatively few people in the universe who has a beer can chicken machine.
Oh, cool!
I don't have a can. I have a machine that recirculates the beer through the chicken.
Wow.
And it gets it pretty crisp, I thought. So I did it. So I said, I'll put this chicken to the ultimate test. I'll cook it the way I would ordinarily cook a Whole Foods chicken or a Giant Eagle chicken. So I did, and it was fabulous.
It was great. The
skin was crisp. The meat was tender and delicious.
You know, I mean, if you reduce the variables, which is what we did, we could compare your chicken to the chicken we always have.
Yeah, I had a straight
and it
comparison.
Was fabulous. Much better chicken.
I mean,
great chicken.
It's not the Bell and Evans chicken from Whole Foods Market. It isn't quite satisfactory chicken, but it's nothing like an Emmer chicken.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, that, and you know, those the two factors are when you go to a slow growth chicken that develops more flavor, and our pasture practices. You know, our birds live from the day they're a chick to when they're, you know, taken away for processing, completely on pasture, unrestricted. There's no, this isn't free range. This is complete freedom. We'll provide them with open-sided hoop houses so that they can roost there at night and, you know, get away from predators. But for the, you know, there is no restrictions on where they can go. There's movable predator fencing that they can walk through. And they can range as far as they want to go. So when they're on pasture, they're, you know, eating seeds and bugs and, you know, grasses and, you know, other things that create just amazing depth of flavor. And they end up being so delicious.
Now, what do the eggs look like? We've been amazed when we go to Europe and we see a Spanish egg or an Italian egg.
Yeah.
And then orange.
And then we come
home and we get a yellow yolk.
I know.
So yours are the same?
Yeah, that is similar. Yeah, so I mean, you know, our production methods are more similar to what happens on, you know, small farms in Europe. And yeah, I mean, it's that brightness of orange that comes from chickens that are on pasture 100% of the time versus, you know, in a barn where it's a controlled diet and, you know, they don't have access to the outside.
Now, you say you're continuing to evolve. And so you will be making changes regularly. A good way of catching up on that, and I guess we really need to ascertain how people go about getting your chickens.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, please check out our website at www.emmerandco.com.
And spelled out. And
Co,
is, Co really refers to community, not company.
That's right. So emmerandco.com.
Right.
And we have a lot of great information on there, and we even have a virtual reality experience where you can see what we mean when we say 100% pasture raised, and that's at emmerandco.com/experience. Our chickens are available through our website as well as through Amazon Fresh nationally in any of the markets that they deliver into. We also have great other online partners like Wild Idea Buffalo, Vital Choice, and, you know, as we grow, we're continually expanding where we're where our markets are and what our customers are. So we also sell to great restaurants in the Bay Area and in Los Angeles. And as we grow, we'll be expanding our retail footprint also.
Yeah, I took a quick look at what's on there. Benu is on there. Charlie Fannis.
Yeah. Charlie Fannis. Oh, Charlie's a good friend of ours.
The Slanted Door, the people at Flour and Water.
Oh, yeah, we're good, yeah.
It's not hard to figure out who makes the best chicken in San Francisco.
We think so, and the chefs tend to agree, so.
Well, thank you so much,
Jesse,
for joining us today. It's a lovely story, and it's only going to get better.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and yeah, I look forward to talking soon.
Yeah, and stay the course, Jesse.
We will.
Thank you so much.
I'm sure, having heard the confidence in the voice of our new friend Jesse, you may be sure that his chickens are going to take over the world.
Yeah, I'd like to have one every night.
Yeah, there you go. So you wish you had one too. And the neat part about it is you don't have to change the way you cook them. I proved that. They're just really good chickens, and can't wait till we get another one. And in the meantime, we need to take a break, right?
Yes.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. How to explain Vicky Jakubovic.
That's
a woman of many hats, and she has her own PR firm, and her clients are, what is that word that means a gazillion? She has lots of clients.
She's a gazillion.
Gazillion, well. At any rate, in this particular interview, she's representing a company that has a gazillion products, Pereg Natural Foods, or PeregGourmet.com, as it's called. And I'm just going to let Vicky explain what all Pereg makes. Vicky Jakubovic, I feel like we're best friends because I've been talking to you or emailing you back and forth forever, it seems. You're many clients. You are a marketing associate for these companies. It's Pereg Natural Foods, and I think it's a fabulous company.
Thank you.
Give us an overview of this company, because the backstory is very interesting too. The family business, it's generation, it's now the third generation, you said.
Correct.
How did it start? When did it start? Just give us a little company color here.
Okay, well, Pereg Natural Foods started in 1906. It started as a spice company, and they started with a small cart and an open-air market. Today, they produce more than 60 exotic all-natural spices, in addition to a complete line of gluten-free flours, ancient grains, baby quinoa, basmati rice, quinoa mixes, and assorted all-natural vegan dairy-free product.
Side dishes.
Yeah, that many of which are great for side dishes and baking and creating all kinds of delicious, healthy recipes that are vegan, gluten-free, and all-natural.
Now, those flours that came yesterday, is that part of it?
Yeah, varieties of gluten-free flours.
And what are, name some of them. They're really interesting.
Yes, they are. They have quinoa gluten-free flour. They have almond gluten-free, banana gluten-free.
Yeah, what's that one like? I saw that. I haven't used it yet because we just got them yesterday.
You know, they're all have different properties for baking, and you can use them in different ways. You kind of have to experiment with them a little bit because gluten-free cooking and baking is a little bit tricky, but we have a lot of information on our website, PeregGourmet.com, that gives you baking tips and ideas of how to make your gluten-free baked goods come out better. And because they have such a good variety, as opposed to just general gluten-free flour, you can really bake up some really good stuff.
Yeah, we had a guest on the program a year or so ago, I guess, who said she despaired of commercial brands of gluten-free flour, so she made her own mixture.
Yeah, she grinds her, mills her own.
And but this would be absolutely perfect for her because she could fiddle around until she got the exact complexion that she wanted. She said that one of the reasons that wheat flour is so popular is because of the way it behaves when you heat it up. And other flours don't behave in the same way. So as a result, you don't get the same result unless you're really careful to figure out what characteristics of what goes in your flour will make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, they offer guidelines for their different gluten-free flours so you can really make something that comes out good. Because some are really made for some kind of baking and others are made for other kind of baking. So this really is a good guide. And because they offer so many different types, you really can bake up some good stuff that tastes good.
This the name of the company is interesting, P-E-R-E-G. I mean,
is that name?
It's a sort of a rather unusual name. Where does that come from?
Pereg is actually a Hebrew name. I believe the company has... is not only based in New Jersey, but also based in Israel.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, got it. Okay.
And so it comes from, it's based on a Hebrew word.
You don't know what it means. I mean, it's not.
I knew what it meant, and I have forgotten, but I'll find out for you.
Well,
I used to know what it meant. It's actually a type of grain, and I just forgot what it is.
Okay.
There you go. That makes a lot of sense.
So, but it's not the family's name. I mean, what is the family?
No, it's not the family's name, no.
So tell us about the family.
I don't know that much about the family, except that it was started, you know, it's the third generation, and that's really, I don't know much else about it besides that.
Okay. You don't know any of the people. Have you ever met any of them?
I've only spoken to them. I know that they are very involved in all their products from start to finish. They control the quality of the sourcing until the product is packed and ready for the consumer. They're very hands-on. This isn't some big corporate company. It's really, they're involved in everything from start to finish, very hands-on. I think that's why their products are so liked by so many people who are careful about their diet and want quality products.
Yeah, well, they're a success. They're a success doing what they're doing.
They are, absolutely. No question about it.
It's a great story. We love their Frika.
Yeah.
The Frika is just outstanding.
Yeah, our grandson likes the Frika.
Great.
We made a big Frika bowl for him when he was visiting recently.
Well, we'll have to send you more.
Yeah, there we go.
Now, this is really a company for the times. I mean, everybody's concerned with healthy, natural eating these days, isn't it? But they started this family, this company started so early, 1906?
Well, I guess they were a little bit ahead of their time.
I would say so. Who would know? Of course, they started with spices, and I guess they've gradually evolved. They're convenient. Are these partially cooked? Because they don't take very long to cook.
No, none of them are cooked, no. Oh, that's it. Pereg is poppy seed. That's what Pereg is.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well
poppy
done.
Poppy seed.
Well done.
Okay. Good remembering.
Yeah. No,
Sorry. Took me a minute.
No, that was well done. So you can order a Pereg bagel, huh?
Right, exactly.
And if you're in the right part of New York City, you'll get the right product.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you can't pass a drug test if you've had that, can you?
that's true.
Poppy seed is the... They had a case that struck me as really excessive. Is this poor young woman had a baby, and she had a poppy seed bagel. And they gave her a subsequent drug test, and she failed it, and they took the baby away from her.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. It was a huge scandal.
That was actually the theme of a Seinfeld program.
Was it?
Yeah. Elaine was going for a new job, and it involved taking a drug test, which she failed.
Because she had a poppy bagel?
And it was because, they were at their diner. You know the diner that's in Seinfeld?
Yeah, of course.
They were at the diner, and it suddenly dawned on Jerry what the problem was, because he was tucking into a poppy seed bagel.
I gotcha.
so you have to be very careful. Now,
very careful. Okay.
Now, we heard somewhere that there was a bit of a crisis in the supply chain for quinoa.
Quinoa, right.
That it's become so popular that the countries where it's grown are having difficulty keeping up with demand. Have you perceived that at all with Pereg, or perhaps you don't get that down to that level of detail with your client?
I haven't gotten that information at all, and I know they source from many different places, and they've been one of the first purveyors of quinoa. So I think that I'm not worried for them and their sources, but it's possible it's happening, but I haven't heard that.
Could you do us a favor? Could you get in touch with them and ask them that question?
Yes, I can.
And see what the answer is, and then we'll put it out on a subsequent program.
I can see if I can get you an answer right now.
Well, this isn't going to air for a few weeks anyway, so whenever you can get an answer to whether or not there really is a quinoa crisis, we can include that in the commentary while we're talking about the program. We can act like we're putting it in the interview right now.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, and now what you're debuting at the Fancy Food Show this year is the baby quinoa. And what is
baby
the... Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Baby quinoa, that's correct.
Yeah, and what is the advantage? Is it even more of a superfood?
Okay, so I'll tell you a bit about baby quinoa. It's dark reddish brown in color. It's about half the size of a quinoa seed, so it's really, really small. Unlike regular quinoa, it doesn't have the coating called a saponin. That's the coating that gives quinoa sometimes a slightly bitter flavor if it's not rinsed properly.
Oh.
Now, all of Pereg's quinoa, baby or otherwise, well, their quinoa is all rinsed, and so there's no need to pre-rinse. But the baby quinoa actually has no saponins, so that it doesn't have that bitterness. It's also a great, great source of iron. It cooks up really quickly, and it can be used in so many different ways. It's very versatile.
Yeah, what happens in our house is every couple of weeks I make a bowl of a mixture of lentils, quinoa, and chia seeds, preferably sprouted. And Mrs. Haig has that with soft-boiled eggs for breakfast, and it's a killer breakfast.
Sounds delicious, and it sounds very healthy.
Yeah, well.
I just got an answer back from the VP of of Pereg, and they said they have no issues regarding quinoa supply.
Great. Okay, well, let's just plug a website in here so that people can get more information if they need it.
Pereggourmet.com.
It's Pereg-Gourmet.
Oh, thank you.
Pereg-Gourmet.com.
Well, thank you so much for bringing the message of quinoa to our program. We've really enjoyed talking to you, and thank you so much, and we wish you much success.
Well, I'm sure we'll be interacting on other products.
Okay, terrific.
Okay, thanks, Nikki. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, next up, a new product with a familiar name. I mean, how can I resist when a product comes across our threshold that's called Peter's Yard?
Right. But, and Peter's Yard has an interesting backstory for
this
company. And it also has a wonderful products, crisp breads. And we'll have Wendy Wilson Matt explain it all to us.
Okay, so our guest is calling us from almost Wales. The name of the city is... Go ahead, Wendy.
I'm calling you from Bridge North, which is in the heart of Shropshire, near Shrewsbury.
Oh, okay, so you're near Shrewsbury.
Yes.
Okay, and the only thing I know about that is
Shropshire Land. There is a poem called The Shropshire Land.
Yeah, there's a whole book of poetry about
it. It's beautiful.
There's a great orange-colored blue-vein cheese called Shropshire Blue.
Yes.
There is, which is delicious with our
crisp
bread.
Exactly. Go on. I knew we would back into this cracker somewhere.
Now, who we're talking to, by the way, we should mention, is Wendy Wilson Bett. Wendy, tell our listeners the interesting story behind this company called Peter's Yard.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Started back in 2007. When my business partner Ian and I were both working for Cadbury Schweppes, big global confectionery and drinks company. So I was managing brands on the chocolate side like Cadbury, but also working with Dr. Pepper and Snapple and brands like that.
Uh-huh.
And both Ian and I, as it happens, we just were friends through work, but we both had a real passion for great food and had both wanted to set up our own businesses. But we'd got kind of wrapped up in the big corporate world and were fortunate enough to both be pretty successful working our way through the ranks.
Uh-huh.
But in 2007, we both sort of had a real urge to do something different. Ian was working on the supply chain side, and my background is sales and marketing. And we decided to look into how we might run a business together. And Ian's wife is Swedish. He's spent quite a lot of time in Sweden.
Uh-huh.
And he was telling me with great passion about how wonderful Swedish bakeries are and that what he really wanted to do was to bring a Swedish bakery to the UK and show people just how much better than other bakeries Swedish bakery products could be.
They're big on crisp breads, right?
They are, but also on lots of other beautiful things.
Okay.
So they also make wonderful cardamom buns, fresh breads, mazarins, that really unusual, lovely range of sort of typically Swedish bakery products. And we had the fortunate and lucky task of going around Sweden, Stockholm and places like that, looking at the products. It was a tough job, but somebody had to do it.
Yes, right.
And we were really looking for inspiration to come back to the UK and set up a business that did something similar. But what was interesting, unusual, and unexpected was that as we did that, we were introduced to somebody called Peter Lundquist, And Peter had set up a bakery in Sweden and had then moved over to Scotland, to Edinburgh, and was running a Swedish bakery cafe, almost exactly what Ian and I had in our heads as something that we wanted to do. And so we were advised to go and have a chat with him. So we flew up to Edinburgh, had a delicious coffee, and talked to him about the whole idea. And out of that idea came our love and interest in the crisp bread, because he had this beautiful product on the shelves that was thin and light and bubbly and just absolutely fantastically made. He said it's really hard work going into the retail business, but we said, how about these crisp bread? They're wonderful. When are you going to take them to other great shops around the UK and abroad? And Peter, who's a very wise entrepreneur, said, I don't know how to do that. And Ian and I looked at each other over our coffee, and having come from a big branded company like Cadbury Schweppes, we said, well, we do. We know how to do that. So having spent years, I mean, literally, I was at Cadbury Schweppes for 22 years and Ian for 18, having spent many years in the big corporate world where we would have spent a lot of time pondering over whether that was a good idea or not, we flew home, gave it a bit of thought, flew back up a couple of weeks later, and put a proposal on the table to join Peter in business. So now we have Peter, who is expert at the retail side of things, but Ian and I are running the what we call the wholesale business and selling the crisp bread into many outlets in the UK. So Top Cheese shops, Selfridges, Whole Foods in the UK, and then also into the US more recently.
Now, you're Wendy, of course, so what is it, you turn right at the corner and keep on going till morning? And then you'll meet.
I'm sorry?
Then you'll meet Peter Pan right there.
Yes, exactly. Peter and Wendy. We have laughed about that.
I don't know how you never figured that out.
But it's been a great partnership. And what happened then, sort of next leg of the journey, was that we started by importing the product that Peter was selling in the retail business. We started by taking that and selling it into some really top restaurants and Fortnum and Mason. And interestingly, this will make you laugh, we were actually approached by the people who do all of the catering for the Cambridge University balls.
Did you know Peter is a Cambridge guy?
Yeah, she read the...
Exactly.
She went to the website.
Right. I looked that up. So I thought, Peter, you'd be interested in that.
Yes, indeed.
But we did begin to realise that it wasn't just us who thought the product was exceptional. A lot of really well-known food writers, chefs, restaurateurs, and buyers were saying there's nothing like this product on the market.
Now there's, there's more than one version, right? We were just eating the crisp bread at lunchtime today, but there's more than one of the things that you make.
Well, the peppercorn, the pink peppercorn, was the one that won the Best New Product Award in crackers for Sophie's.
But go over the whole product line for us.
But we do, Peter, we do just make crisp bread. So although we went to Sweden with a view to looking at a lot of different types of products, the crisp bread is so good and has grown so fast for us that actually we have focused on just making crisp bread. We do different varieties, different sizes.
Yeah, that's what I was asking you to tell our listeners about, because I call them round ones and square ones.
Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about the round one then.
Go ahead.
Because the round one has a hole in the middle, and that's because historically, crisp bread was made hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Crisp bread was made as a means of preserving bread. So the home of crisp bread is Sweden, and obviously they had incredibly long, still do, long, cold, dark winters. And so the tradition of preserving fish with gravlax or fruit with jams and bread with crisp bread has been very much at the heart of Swedish food history and culture. And the crisp bread was made in a large round shape, a hole stamped in the middle, and then that was used to thread them over a pole and that pole could be hung up under the eaves in the house or above the fireplace, because then they'd keep dry and could be used right the way through until the next harvest when they'd make another batch.
Interesting.
We've kept to that tradition on the larger ones of putting a hole in the middle, because it's a true part of the true history of crisp bread.
But there's some smaller ones which are round as well.
Are they the pink peppercorn ones? Absolutely, and a caraway one, which is so pink peppercorn and caraway square, and then our original recipe, which is the one we started out with. All of the sizes of that are round.
Okay. Well, there are endless possibilities for flavor variations with crisp bread.
Now, here's an interesting question for you. We love crackers. We would put crisp bread in the crackers category, but we really like them. But several years ago, it's probably as long as 8 or 10 years ago now, we came across a cracker that was made in Australia called 34 Degrees. You remember 34 Degrees?
I do. You know it?
But apparently somebody bought them out and is making the 34 Degrees crackers in the U.S. now. And we have heard people talking to us at the Fancy Food Show saying it can be quite difficult to pass through the USDA and all the other regulations that you have to meet in order to sell an overseas food product in the United States. Now, have you come across anything like that, or you just knew how to do it?
Well, it's I think there have been some challenges. It's why we decided to work with an expert in export and somebody who knew the market really well. So we had to change the packaging. So our packaging is unique to the U.S. market, so that technically we meet all the right standards. There are some things which are different for us. So an example is where we can, we love to use organic ingredients. Our ingredients are very, very simple, or, you know, sourced from the best suppliers and natural. But our milk, for example, there's a lot of fresh milk in our crisp bread, and it's we always source it from organic suppliers. But we're not able to make that claim in the U.S. because the standards of
they don't know what they're going to be. Very different.
Yeah. So there are some things where we realise we can't necessarily make all of the same claims in the U.S. as the U.K. But right. Apart from that, and the distance of not being able to hop on a plane and talk to our customers regularly, apart from that, it's been great, and we've really had some fabulous listings. You know, we're in places like Dean De Luca, some of the Whole Foods regions there, and in Central Markets in Texas and Bristol Farms in LA. So we really want to just make sure that we do in the States what we've done in the UK, which is to go slowly, find the best, the very best shops, like Bedford Cheese Shop and places like that, and check that people there love our product as much as people here do. And it's earlier, because we really, although we've been working with our export partner for a long time for the US, we only really went into the US 2 years ago. So it's still very new. So we're trying to be patient, but it's lovely, and thank you again. It's lovely that, you know, you've reached out to us and that you like the product. You know, that means a lot, and it means that we're hearing the same kind of things there as we did here in the UK, that people who really know food do love it.
Well, we wish you the very best. We hope for your continued success. It sounds like you really are being very careful and thoughtful. It's good to hear a success story from the good old UK, which is my native land after all.
Yes.
Sometimes it seems like things don't go over all that well, but this is a success we can report, and that's absolutely terrific. And you're to be congratulated, and please say hello to Peter, my namesake.
I will. I'll certainly do that. And there's another tiny little link back to the U.S., actually, which is that our product's made from sourdough. And the original sourdough that was used by the person who invented our recipe, Jan Head, who is a really famous Swedish baker, bought his starter from the U.S.
Oh, that's great.
It makes a real difference to the product. It's allowed to ferment for 16 hours before we make each batch. So I think the great thing for us about the foodie market in the States and here is that people are really beginning to appreciate bread made properly, made with sourdough, yes, rather than raised through a factory somewhere.
Yeah, it's become a very big issue in the States, bread.
Wendy, once again, thank you for joining us
today. Yeah, Wendy, it was great meeting you.
And keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, so we said we'd have a surprise for you at the end of the program. Here's a surprise. Did you know? Did you know that SOS, makers of cleaning products for the kitchen, do you know what it stands for? Mrs. Hagan, do you remember what it stands for?
No.
The answer is Save Our Saucepans.
Oh.
And it's just a fascinating story, so let's have this nice lady just
Christine
explain
McFadden.
It all.
Yes. Christine McFadden is joining us today to celebrate a very big anniversary. It's the 100th anniversary, 100 years for SOS soap pads. This is kind of, Christine, a first for our program, because we don't usually do cleaners and things. But
well, I'm absolutely honored.
Oh, well, this is amazing. I mean, we couldn't, first of all, live without SOS pads. Give us the story, because I think the story itself was what caught my eye.
Sure, how SOS pads became a thing.
Yes.
So first of all, thank you so much for having me on your show today. I really appreciate it. You're right, this is a huge anniversary. There aren't many products out there that can say they've been around for 100 years, so we're very proud of that. But so back in 1917, there was a cooking utensil salesman, and his name was Irwin Cox, and he sold pots and pans and things like that door-to-door. And he was a bit of an entrepreneur, and he wanted to give a little something extra to help push his ability to sell more pots and pans. So he developed something in his basement where he took basically steel wool and dipped it in soap and then let it air dry. And then when he sold these pots and pans to the different families, he would give them a couple of these soap pads for free, just kind of as a thanks for buying from me. Or if he was having trouble selling the soap pads, he would say, selling the pots and pans, he would say, here, I'm going to give you these free cleaner tools that are really going to help you out. And that helped him to sell more pots and pans. So after doing this, what he realized was people were much, much more interested in the soap pads than they were in the pots and pans. So, and his wife actually named them SOS. And they're named SOS, which stands for Save Our Saucepans.
Yes.
And that's how SOS started.
That's what it's called. Okay,
yes.
Wow.
Save Our Saucepans.
I have a feeling that somewhere in his early life, this man who you might think sounds more like Willie Loman in The Death of a Salesman than anybody else.
He does. It's funny you say that. Whenever I tell that story, that's exactly who I picture in my head, Willie
yeah, me
Loman.
Too.
But the funny thing is, here's what I was going to say. It seems like earlier in life, he must have gotten to know King Gillette. And let me explain why. Because King Gillette got tired of selling razors and realized that what he really wanted to do was sell the blades. He really didn't want to sell razors at all. What he wanted to create was a razor that had a removable blade, so that people would buy them, in order to have a sharp shave whenever they wanted.
Yep.
And the rest.
There you go. Another great example of innovation.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
The rest is history. That's right.
Now,
that's right.
Peter was asking, what did people do? Because we couldn't even imagine. What did people do before these soap pads?
Yeah. So, when you go back 100 years and you think about what was happening back in 1917, it becomes very clear why these were so popular. Because
back in, you know, the early 1900s, housework was really, really hard work, very manual, literally would take all day. And the reason is because things like electricity and indoor plumbing, I mean, those, that was still considered a luxury.
Mm-hmm.
Most families didn't have those things. So, you know, a vacuum cleaner or a clothes washer, I mean, you didn't have those things. Everything was done by hand. You know, so if you don't have running water, then what people used to do is they'd heat a boiler full of water over a coal or a wood range. They would literally, you know, for instance, boil their clothes or, you know, boil rags or whatever it was that they needed to clean. Then they'd rub them on a washboard and use a hand wringer and hang them out to dry. And so just the act of, for instance, washing clothes would take all day. So, for instance, you know, washing these pots and pans, you know, what people actually used to do was they would use things like, squares of cheesecloth or old flour bags, and they would scrub and scrub and scrub and scrub. And so when, you know, our Willie Loman, our Irwin Cox gentleman, you know, came to these people's houses and handed them these little wonders and said, here, all you have to do is put some water on this, give it a squeeze, all the soap is there, and give it a rub, and they, you know, what was once a really difficult household chore suddenly became incredibly easy.
Now, the funny thing about it is that steel wool, in fact, already existed, right?
It did indeed.
Now, did the old bartender's friend exist too? That's the part.
I tend to doubt that. No, I don't think they're having a 100-year anniversary like us.
No, no. I mean, the brands like Ajax. I mean, the powdered stuff. I mean,
Borax was definitely around.
Okay.
I do know that. I'm not sure about Ajax, but I do know that women, and because primarily women did, of course, the cleaning back then. They used borax and they used ammonia. And some really harsh soap. So, honestly, not only was it difficult to get things cleaned, but it was murder on your hands.
Oh, yeah.
You know, imagine having your hands in really harsh chemicals for a good you know, portion of the day.
Oh,
so
sure,
household cleaning was not a fun thing.
Yeah, I mean, if I have a really tough job, if I have a tough pot to clean, I put the white powder on first, and then I get even more abrasion from the steel wool. But it's interesting that steel wool existed. Maybe it was an industrial product rather than a domestic product.
Well, how does this history relate to Clorox, which is the company that owns this brand
today?
Yeah. So Irwin Cox, when he started his company, it was actually called the SOS Company for many, many years. The patent for SOS was issued to him in 1918. And then all through the 20s and 30s, it was a company that he built and ran. Then, the company was actually sold to General Foods in 1958.
Oh, wow.
And then from there, yep, so General Foods actually had the SOS brand. And General Foods actually, back in the 50s, was a company that, specific to SOS, introduced a lot of engineering and efficiency improvements in terms of how the product was made. The product itself hasn't really, I mean, it's certainly changed in terms of the, you know, the soap is better and there's rust inhibitors in the soap now and things like that. But the product itself is, you know, somewhat similar to what it was 100 years ago. But one of the things that General Foods did is they introduced a lot of production efficiencies, that kind of thing.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, then it was sold to Miles Laboratories, and then Clorox Company actually purchased SOS in 1994.
And that's recent. Fairly recent.
Yeah.
Now, are they still made in the USA?
100% made in the USA.
Yeah.
Yep. SOS pads are made in Chicago, Illinois. Yep.
How fabulous.
Now, I'm going to say a dirty word.
not Brillo.
Yes, Brillo. How?
That's a...
Yeah, go ahead. How different are they?
That's okay.
Yeah, but how does it differ from Brillo pads?
So, quite a bit of difference, we like to say, actually. So, yes, you Brillo is certainly another product that, you know, is known for their soap pads. I will say, little thing here, SOS is the number one selling soap pad in the U.S. and has been for a long time. But there are quite a few differences. I mean, you know, if you were talking to someone from Brillo, I'm sure they would say different things. But we actually, one of the things that we talk about, there's some lab testing that we've done, Brillo pads versus SOS pads. Besides the obvious things, which obviously SOS pads are blue, Brillo pads are pink. But so there's one thing. But besides that, the most important thing that our lab test found, Brillo versus SOS, is SOS lasts longer. It has 23% more soap than a Brillo pad does. And SOS soap pads, because of the way they're constructed, they also clean faster. So it takes less scrubs to clean whatever it is you're cleaning if you're using an SOS pad instead of a Brillo pad.
Good girl, so, Christine.
yeah. So I have got my research here. Lab tests prove it. So, but yes.
You know, this longevity, I mean, everything has changed so drastically and dramatically since the invention of this soap pad. People just generally think of it as cleaning pads and cooking utensils, which is why it's on a food and drink show. But there are all these other uses that you list that you've thought of and people use it for. Some of them are rather amazing. Tell us what some of those are, besides
besides the obvious.
Well, yeah, but there's...
Besides the obvious, right.
Go ahead.
No, you're absolutely right. So, and it's interesting because some uses we, you know, came up with ourselves in terms of R&D and other things, but a lot of uses, customers write into us or call in and say, hey, I use it for XYZ and it works great. So, some examples. One of the things that a lot of people use SOS pads for, have you ever bought, like for instance, a candle, like a glass candle or a jar or something, and there's that sticky label that's
you
on the bottom.
Get up. And I use an SOS pad to get it off.
They're great for that. They are great for that. Just wet the pad, one or two swipes across the label, and it comes right off.
Right.
So that's one. We have golfers that keep SOS pads in their golf bags, because they work great to clean an iron. So, you know, when you maybe shank a shot and you get all that grass and mud and stuff and the ridges of the iron, SOS pads work great to get those sparkling clean again so that there's no mud or gook or grass or anything.
Who's your spokesperson? Is it Phil Mickelson or Tiger Woods?
I know. We need one, don't we?
You
know, it's funny you say that because back in, gosh, I don't know when it was, but there was, and I'm afraid I don't know the person, but there was a golfer. I think his name was Sam Snead. Does that
ring
a bell?
Yeah, that's sure,
a long time ago.
Okay. Well, he was a spokesperson. Sam Snead was a spokesperson for SOS back in the day. So we need to get a Tiger or Mickelson or somebody on board today, don't we?
I guess you can think about it anyway.
So white walls and tires is another use, right?
Yep.
That's
white walls,
one.
Tires, plastic shoes, those flip-flops. That you wear all summer and they get kind of grungy, those plastic flip-flops. SOS works great to clean those up. Patio furniture, garden tools, barbecue grills, the grills not only on your outdoor barbecue but even inside your oven, the oven grates, oven racks.
Oh, yeah, of course.
SOS works great because it's got the grease fighter in the soap, right, built right in, so cleans those up in a flash. So yeah, there's a bunch of different uses for SOS. Every spring I have parents write in and talk about how they give an SOS pad to their kids to clean up their bikes for the summer. The tires and yeah. So
I thought you were going to say they were just saying don't just use soap, use SOS to get yourself clean.
No, we don't recommend it on skin.
You don't recommend it on skin,
kids.
Okay.
This is great. I'm so happy for you, for your company.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, and it's just, well, it was a joy to be able to book you into this program, a change of pace. Being as serious as it is, it's also a lot of fun.
Let's get the name of that inventor out again for us.
Yes, Irwin Cox is his name. And I should mention, if you go to our website, sosclorox.com, so sosclorox.com, there's a bunch of history about the SOS brand, pictures of some old ads, different uses and tips and tricks and all sorts of great stuff out there.
Well, it's wonderful. It's a name worth reckoning with and a fascinating story. We thank you for bringing it to us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm very happy to have joined you today, and I appreciate the invitation.
Thanks, Christine.
Christine reminded me there were a couple of things we forgot. Go ahead.
Well, just a couple things. I wanted to make sure that people did know that they can find SOS not only at our website, but we're really active on social media. So our Facebook page, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube. We would love for you to join us on those channels.
And
we also
talked
a little bit of
the different flavors.
Yeah, and SOS, we like to say SOS does come in different flavors. So not literal flavors, but SOS can be found with a lemon scent or a lavender scent, different sizes. We have something called a clean and toss. That's a one-use size and toss it. And then there's also SOS non-scratch scrubbers. So for those things that you, a steel wool would be too harsh on, so you need something for a delicate surface, like a nonstick pan or delicate china, we have SOS non-scratch scrubbers available for those particular things.
I can imagine what you're going to come up with in the next 100 years if you've come up with,
yes,
with this many in the first 100 years. So once again, Christine,
absolutely,
thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Well, who knew? You waited, but who knew? At any rate, moving on, we'll be back here, same time,
same
place
next week.
And until then, bye-bye.